that you can claim to have Iman and be a mu'min and think that you can get away and not be tried by Allah, not be tested by Allah? No, you will be tested. You will be tried, just like those who were before you were tried. And hence, these trials and these tests that Allah gives to believers. This is our subject. And why these trials, they come down on us? What are the reasons behind it? So that when we learn the reasons for these trials, we will know how to act in front of these trials and be patient in the face of these trials. Otherwise, if we don't even know the reason for the trials, we wouldn't know how to face these trials, and we would lose in our exam, and we would lose in our test. And we will keep on failing because we never knew the reason of why they're coming on us. So until now, I mentioned two reasons. The first one, which Ahlul Bayt have mentioned, and Imam Ali alayhi salatu wa salam. He mentioned that the first reason that sufferings happen in your life, and your life is full of miseries, is because of your own sins. He speaks of it in Dua Iqbal and says, Allahumma ighfir li dhunuba allati tunzilu al-bala. Allah, forgive me of those sins that bring down bala and affliction and suffering in my life. So there are certain sins that bring down bala, and we might do some of those sins so that we know that if we are doing those sins, and if we see that our life is in a miserable condition, and that we are going through suffering, then it is our own fault. There's no need to blame Allah for it, no need to say that Allah is testing us. We haven't reached the stage of test yet if we are doing the sins ourselves. Once we stop doing those sins that bring down affliction, then we will reach the realm of being tested by Allah. So when we see ourselves in suffering, then every moment know he is going through some suffering in life. He goes through trials in life, no matter what it is, what form it is, what shape it is, it doesn't matter. But no one in this room can claim that they are not going through any hardships in life. And if they do, then everyone will look at them questioning their faith. The issue is that this is a room full of believers, and believers are going through hardships. So, first of all, we need to see whether we are doing those sins and check them off. If we are not doing those sins, then the second reason applies that I explained yesterday. And that is, Allah gives us difficulties so He can protect us from impending harms that are coming our way. So that we don't face the greater harm and the greater danger ahead of us. If you see that you're traveling on a road and you see a detour, you know, there's a bridge, the bridge is not built. If you go on the bridge, you will fall off the bridge. So they put a detour there. Now you take a detour, and you're wasting your time now trying to go through alleyways and small streets and potholes. It is bothersome, it is inconvenient, but it is less inconvenient than falling off a bridge. It's less inconvenient for him to pray. So, appreciate the detour. If the sign wasn't there, if the inconvenience wasn't there, then you would be in a much bigger problem. So Allah gives us detours so that we take those detours in order to avoid greater problems. Now those who don't believe in Him, He lets them go on the bridge. He lets them go on the bridge and they can fall off. Right? But those who are believers, Allah cares about them. That's why He makes detours for them so that they can be protected from greater harm. This is the second reason why He gives us trials and difficulties. Right? And sometimes He wants to give us something. He wants to give us something But in order to get that, you have to go through some trials to get it. That's the only way to get there. You know, one of the good wives of the Prophet, Umm Salma, she was an obedient wife. And you know, a lot of people don't know her history. And I'll just explain to you her history in 2 minutes. Umm Salama was a veteran of 2 migrations. She migrated to Ethiopia and she migrated to Medina. She went to Ethiopia in the group that went in the migration to Ethiopia. But when that migration was taking place, there was a false rumor that the Prophet had made an agreement with the Kufar of Makkah. So, some of the group heard this rumor and they came back in the middle of the migration. She and her husband were one of those people who returned to Makkah. And then when they returned to Makkah, they found out that this was a false rumor and there was no agreement, and they had to go to the torture of being persecuted by the Makkahs. She went through that. And then after that, you see, she went again, made another migration. After facing all that hardship, she made another migration to Medina with the rest of the Muslims who made the migration and hijrah to Medina. Now, she was a veteran of these 2 migrations. She and her husband both are together. Both have lived through it. Both have lived through the hardships and they stuck with their faith. They never left the Prophet, they never left their deen. They went through the hardships, they went through the pain of defending their deen and defending themselves against the persecution of infidels. That is her history. Imagine this. And then when they came to Medina, they lived in a, I wouldn't say a ghetto, because when you imagine what a ghetto is, it's inside the city. There the ghetto is outside the city, like a shanty town. You know, you go outside the city, you know, old America, you know, I mean, this was the place where the slave, ex-slave used to live across the railroad tracks. They used to live there and, you know, there's no water there, nothing there, you know. And in Medina, there was a place for poor people. She ended up over there after her husband died in the Battle of Uhud. Her husband died in the Battle of Uhud and she ended up there because there was no income coming in the house. She was a single mother trying to raise her children. It was hard. And she didn't even want to tell the Prophet because her husband is Shaheed and the government, Islamic government, owes Shuhada and hence they take care of them. It's their job to take care of them. But she was a believer with that much ma'rifat, knowing that after the Battle of Uhud, so many people had died, that not only does the Prophet have to deal with the poor conditions of the Muslim, now he has to deal with a lot more widows on his hand. And the Muslims have to deal with it, and they have to share what they have in order to take care of them. But she had that much ma'rifat that she never asked the Prophet for anything. She never asked him for a handout, she never asked him to say that, my husband is Shaheed, you owe me something. Because knowing that how much the Prophet already has on his hand, she didn't want to bother him. So one day when things really got bad, she sent her son that I want you to go and ask the Prophet for something. But not money, not wealth, not property, nothing. Nothing material. He said, I trust in Allah. Go and ask him. With one letter she wrote to the Prophet, he said, all I want from you is a dua that I can read, that I can better my situation with. And in reply, you see that Rasulullah, he gave her a dua that is called Ni'mul Badal. You will see a dua box, dua Ni'mul Badal. This is the dua that he taught to Umm Salma. He sent that dua back with her son. But with that dua, he sent a message to her. He sent a message to her and said, listen, Allah has taken a husband away from you, but you are a believer, and Allah, whatever He takes from believers, He gives them something better than what He has taken. And she was like, who could be better than my husband? He is shaheed. He made migration. He did all these things. But you see, how did she know that the trouble she went through, going through those migrations and pain, difficulties and hardships, and living in shanty towns and slums of Medina, did you see that? Who would know that after going through all that, what the Prophet had meant is that you're going to be the wife of the greatest person on earth.
No.
Now, Miss Alma, you went through all that, now you say, was this reward of Allah better or what? Look at what you got and look at what He took. And He has rewarded you with this. My friends, understand, Allah wants to give something better, so He takes something that's there and He will give something better for a believer. Now we come to the third reason why Allah puts us through trials. The third reason is why these trials and sufferings are coming in our life. Let me explain that to send you some of us. Even if I give it to you, you wouldn't even know what to do with it. Imagine this, my sense. What happened, right, is this. Sometimes we are unable to use the things. We are not capable. You see, and even if he gives it, then, you know, what happens with it? How long is it going to be with us? You know, I mean, he wants to give us something precious. How long is it going to be with us? You know, 40 years? 50 years? 60 years? Then what? Then eventually we're going to separate from it. We're going to leave it. It's not going to be with us all the time. I mean, the blessings that Allah did give you, how long are these blessings with you for? The very eyes He gave you to see, the tongue He gave you to speak, the fingers He gave you to use, the feet He gave you to walk, all these blessings that He has given us, how long are they for? Again, only for a little while. Allah, these are blessings, and every blessing of Allah is something that we cannot even account for it. We can't even account for the even smallest of blessings. The air we breathe. You know, blessings Allah is giving us. We can't even account for it. The issue is that Allah wants to give, but He knows that your time is limited here. You can't use it here. And hence what happens, Allah wants to give it in a place where you can actually use it. And you cannot have it, and you can have it. And you know what? Not for 50 years, not for 60 years. He said, I want to give it to you in a place where you will have it forever. My friends, do you know what forever is? You see, we don't realize it or we don't put it in perspective. That's why we can't understand it. Allah says about the Akhirah and the hereafter. He says in the Quran that one day of Akhirah, kana miqdaruhu alfa. You know that one day of the hereafter is equal to 50,000 years. Amsina alfa sana. 50,000 years of this world. One day of the Akhirat, of the hereafter, is equal to 50,000 years in this dunya. 50,000 years. Right? Now, listening to a figure is easy. Now let me put it in perspective for you. He's saying one day of the Akhirat, one day, right, 24 hours, is equal to 50,000 years here. You know how long is 50,000 years? My friends, from Adam till now is not more than 15,000 years. It's not even 15,000 years, not even that much. It's about 11, 12,000 years. Meaning, from Adam until all the way till now, we haven't lived even a part of one day in the hereafter. We haven't lived a part of one day in the hereafter. And here we see that Allah is saying that I want to give you rewards there. And we look at our lives, our life is like a speck in the timeline of human life here. Not even a speck. We need a microscope to look at our life. Where is our life in the timeline of human life? Where are we lost? And we see that we are in the middle of nowhere. And this small life, he says, you know, what can I give you here? And for what? For my worship? For my prayers? For my fasting? What can be worth it here to give you a reward for that in this world? Sometimes what happens, we are hasty. We ask for things in the wrong places. We don't understand that the reason Allah is not giving us here and we are going through this poverty and this hardship and difficulties is because He wants to give it in a place where it's going to last. And here we are asking Allah, you know, I pray to you, you know, give me something in return. Give me something, you know, I need something to go by. 이만 박근혜 대사라고 You know, he spoke of this husband and wife. Husband and wife who lived in the time of Bani Israel, in the prophet Bani Israel. And they were Mu'min people, believers, who used to believe in Allah. Good believers too. Not only were they Mu'min, but they were hardworking also. Meaning they were religious and hardworking. This is a very difficult combination. Everyone knows that when the person becomes religious, the first sign of his religiousness is he's lazy. See that? If you want to see the religious people, you'll see. That's what happens. So if you're religious and hardworking, you know, this is a great combination. You know, and these people were hardworking also. The husband used to work hard for his living. He used to work very hard and he used to spend a lot of time working and praying to Allah, doing the thing that he's required to do. And after doing all that, he saw that his life is still miserable. It's not working out. It's hard for him to just get by the month. His family is hungry. Really, I mean, at times you feel this in life, you know, that I'm working, I'm doing all these things, but still, you know, I really don't have the means to be living easily. I mean, everything is hard. You know, at the end of the month, you see that you're always a day late and a penny short. And you're wondering what's going on with my life. Now, all the bills are late. They're always one day late or $1 short. You know? He's never able to meet the expenses. What's going on? And he's asking the same question. What's going on? And him and his wife are discussing, we're doing everything right. We're reading the dua that we are told to read. We are making ibadat. We are working. We're doing all the good things. Why is this that we're not getting anything? And so they said that we should do some amal, some deeds, some actions, some ibadat. Something, you know, to make us you know, ask Allah for something. So, you know, they decided to do their ibadat, you know. And, you know, for example, men and women, their ibadat is different from one another, you know. You know, like, there are many different ways of doing ibadat, you know. Men and women, Imam Ali Ibn Hadith has mentioned 170 differences between men and women, right? Meaning, for example, the way the men make wudu is from the outside. When they wash their hair, they wash it outside. The woman washes from the inside. Right? Like when the men, they make sajda on the ground, their elbows are above the ground. When the woman makes sajda, their elbows are on the ground. Like these differences. Amongst them, there's one difference that men, when they want to do an amal or do deep ibadat, they should go and do it under the sky, meaning in open land. And for women, it is recommended that they go in the deepest part of their house, the most secret room of their house, and do their ibadah there. So the husband decided, you know what, it's time for me to do this. You know, I'm going to go and read this long dua and ibadah until Allah gives me something. You know, making all this ibadah for him, and still, you know, and Allah will give him. They're not like, you know, demanding from Allah that Allah, you better. No, it's not for you better, it's for you. Allah, you're generous, you can't, you know, we believe you're generous. You know, that attitude. It's not an arrogant attitude. So they go there, and he goes there out of the jungle to make ibadah, worship. And he's worshiping for like 2 days. You know, he worships, and he sees something fall beside him. You know, looks around to see what it is, and it's a precious stone. A precious stone, a ruby, an emerald, or some sort of precious stone. He knows it's worth a lot of it weighs, you know. It's heavy. He sees it's heavy, he knows it's precious, and you know what? All he could do is thank Allah. Allah, thank you, and he made sajda, and he was crying, and I always believe in you, and you are the generous one, and this and that, and now, you know, all his problems are finished. He got the problem. He got the ticket. He is now able to take care of all his problems, pay off all his debts, get ahead in life. And he's really happy now. All of a sudden, in that glee and in that happiness and that excitement, he comes home. And he tells his wife, honey, look what I got. You know, I got this red stone. And she's like looking at, is it real? Of course it's real. We take from Allah, you know. He only deals in real stuff, you know. Yes, it's real. They look at it, it's all good. I mean, it's, you know, they're, both of them are excited. Both of them are excited that now Allah solved their problems. Allah gave this to them and solved their problems. And now, tomorrow, they'll go and get the price for this and take care of their debts and all the things that they have to do in life. Imagine, you would also be happy. You would be glad to do this, right? So now they're waiting for the day to come. And so what happens? Waiting for the day, they fall asleep. They fall asleep. And you know strange things happen when you sleep at this time. So here it comes. They had a strange dream. And the reason I say strange is because both of them saw the same dream. And they saw each other in the dream, doing the same thing. And what they saw in the dream was that they were looking, I mean they woke up, and they woke up on the day of judgment, and an angel came to them and said, listen, you have been chosen to go to heaven, your house is in heaven. They're like, really? Here's your visa, ticket, now go. So now, you know, obviously they get on the bus to go to heaven. I mean, whatever the transportation was, right? And, you know, they see themselves stopping at checkpoints, so they're impatient. You know, looking at the checkpoint, and listen, we don't need to go, we have a visa, don't you see, you know, can't stop us. You know, because in heaven, you know, for example, on the way to heaven, there are checkpoints. There's, you know, a lot of checkpoints, one for prayer, one for fasting. Everywhere you will be asked about these things. You know, and you have to give account of everything. And so now they have a visa to go directly to heaven. No checkpoints, and they are ready to it. And they can't wait to get to their house in heaven. And they get inside the gate of heaven and they can see, you know, it's just the way they imagine. I mean, more than what they imagine it to be. It's like a dream that came to them. I mean, everything was so perfect. Everything was so good. And they're like looking at this place and they're like, wow, this is it. Now they're running to their address, you know, their home. You know, here you come to your house. And you see the house. They saw the house. And it's just picture perfect. This is the house. This is it. This is where we're going to live. You know, having a house in heaven is different than having a house in dunya. You know, in dunya, you don't know how long you're going to have it for. You know, it could be 10, 20 years. Nowadays, you know, with the foreclosures going on, it could be 2 years. So, you get into a house, you know you're going to leave it, right? You know you're going to leave it eventually, right? But the issue is, in heaven, when you get into a house, that's it, you're going to stay there forever. So, you're going to a house in heaven, that's going to be yours forever now. That's it. This is for you. You're not going to move out of here, right? This is your house. And, you know, they get into the house, it's just like they imagine, they are in love with their house. They go through all the room, they see the kitchen, you know, everything, and it's just like great. Everything is great and all these things. And they come to the master bedroom where they're going to sleep. You know, this is it. This is where they're going to live. And they're going to stay here. And, you know, they lay on the bed, and all of a sudden, in the roof, they see a hole. An obvious mistake. Someone left a hole in the roof. Someone left a hole in the roof. They're like, Ya Allah, what happened? Wait a minute. Ya Allah, there's something wrong with the roof here. You know? I mean, we need to look into this. You know, because, you know, over there, you know, you're not going to get anyone to come and, you know, do work at your house. If you get a hole in the roof, you got a hole in the roof, you got to live with it forever. And they're saying like, Allah, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. There's something wrong here. Whoever you hired to build this house didn't do a good job. Come and, you know, do something about it. Ya Allah, Look at this house. There's a mistake over here. Obvious mistake. I mean, you know, we are going to sleep here and you're going to see that bowl. There's something wrong here, right? So now they ask Allah that, Ya Allah, this is all happening in the dream. Ya Allah, someone made a hole in our house. Allah said, what are you saying? You know, the angel said, what are you saying? He said, listen, there's a hole in the house. Who made this hole? The angel said, you all did. We never came here before. This is the first time you're stepping in the house. This is the first time you're coming in the house. We never came here before. Allah said, no, you made the hole. When did we make the hole? He said, remember that time that you asked me something for your prayers.
No, but.
So where do you think it came from? Where did you think it came from? It came from your house in heaven. It was given to you in the earth. You wanted it there, so I gave it to you there. And you spent it there. Now you don't have it here. If you had waited, then you would have had this in this house forever. But you used it over there. I mean, this was a shocker for them, right? I mean, anyone, you know? You have this perfect dream at the end, it's like a waterfall, 90 degrees downwards. And they just woke up, both of them woke up. And they just looked at each other. You know, the husband, you know, told the wife, what are you looking at? I said, no, what are you looking at? Said, did you see a dream? Yeah, I saw a dream. What do you see in the dream? And they shared their dream together. And they were like, shocked. He said, what's going on? Now, after they spoke about the dream, they looked at that stone on the bed. Now, what are you going to do with this stone? Now, they took that stone to the prophet of their time. They spoke it to the prophet of their time and they said, that listen, we saw this dream, what does it mean? The prophet said, it means what it is. Allah wants to reward the believers in the hereafter so that they can have the reward forever. But those who are hasty, they ask for that reward in this dunya. And Allah will give it to them here. But they can only use it while they're here. They will not get it there. Then they said, we don't want this here, that we want it in the hereafter. Then he said, then go give it in the way of Allah. It will make you there. My friends, this is what happens. This is the third reason. The reason is that Allah wants to give us reward, but He wants to reward us for our ibadah in the hereafter where we can use it forever. Where we can have it forever, where we can do things forever. This is for our ibadah we are saying. When we worship Allah, pray to Allah, Allah doesn't want to give the reward in this dunya for that worship. Hey, my friends, when you worship Allah, do not cheapen your worship by asking for a reward for it in this dunya. Don't make it that cheap that, you know, the reward for ibadah and worship of Allah is anything equal in this dunya. You know what the first person to do that? The first person to ask for reward of his ibadah in this dunya. Thank you. Shaitan. Shaitan was the first one who asked for reward of his ibadah, of his worship in this dunya. Imagine that Allah is generous. And Allah gave Shaitan the chance that really I haven't seen anywhere in ayat and hadith He gave anyone else. Really He gave him a chance. When Shaitan did not make sajda to Adam and, you know, was kicked out, so Shaitan said, Allah, you know, okay, you would have kicked me out, but I want some reward, you know, the walking money, you know. Kicking me out. Give me something to walk out with. What? What do we owe you? You know, like, you owe us something? I mean, whoa, for what? He said, Allah, you know, 6,000 years of worship. I bend my back for you. You know? I mean, I've grown old worshiping you. There needs to be some reward for it. Right? That much, about 6,000 years of ibadat is not a joke, my friends. You know, 6 rakat and you're tired. 6 rakat and you're tired, baby. You know, you have to give it to Shaitan, man. 6,000 years? That's good. You know, that's good. Really, it's good. You know, but, you know, when the time came, you know, and he said that 6,000 years of worship of life should be, it has to be worth something. Give me something for it. And I said, all right, you know, what do you want? Imagine, what do you want? My friends, when Allah asks you an open-ended question like that, meaning He is giving you a chance to ask Him anything, and Allah is generous, He is not going to say no. I mean, for example, when we ask our children, whatever you want, my son, he says, Xbox, oh, not that, something else. It's different, right? He says, Allah, He's saying, what do you want? Shaitan could have asked for anything. Shaitan could have asked for anything. He could have said, Allah, please forgive me. I made a mistake. So what do you think? Allah would have said, no, not that, something else. Oh, Allah would have answered him. He would have said, okay. If Shaitan had said, Ya Allah, all I want is Jannah, just send me to heaven again. So what's Allah going to say? No, you can't go there now. Allah said, whatever, ask me what you want for your worship. I'm ready to give it to you. You see, my friends, the problem with Shaitan was not ibadat. Worship was not the problem of Shaitan. He does a lot of worship. Wow. You see, Shaitan does a lot of worship. The problem with Shaitan is that there was no ma'rifat in his worship. There was no ma'rifat, there was no understanding in his worship. You see, there are people who worship a lot, but they have no understanding. Right? And they always are doing the worship of Shaitan. You see, he had worship, he had no ma'rifat. If he had ma'rifat, then he wouldn't have asked for such a cheap price for his ibadat. He said, Allah, give me a long life. Give me a longer life. I mean, okay, you know, you live for 100 years. Right? And you want to live how long? 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years? What's that going to get you? You see, my friends, 6,000 years of worship, he asked for a long life. Allah said, you got it. Go ahead. Take the long life and go. He took the long life. What was it for? Jannat is forever. He left forever in order to ask for something here. If he had ma'rifat, if he had understanding, if he had knowledge, then he would have known that the price of Allah's worship is not in this dunya. It can only be given in the after. It can only be given in the hereafter. It cannot be given here. The price for Allah's worship is not here, my friend. It's there. That's why Allah says, you worship me, I want to reward you. I want to give you everything. What do you think? I can't give it to you, I'm holding back. The only reason I'm holding back is because I want to give it to you in a place where you can use it forever. Where you are actually able to use it. That's why I want to give it to you there. You know, this is why Allah is saying that I want to give you, but I want to give it there where you can use it, my friends. This is why He doesn't give it here. So we feel that Allah is putting us through trials by not giving us the rewards. No, it is because Allah wants to give it, but when we can use it. This is the reason. And when we worship Allah, when we pray to Allah and fast to Allah, my friends, if someone has iman, if someone has ma'rifat, if someone has understanding and knowledge, then they will not cheapen the worship of Allah by asking the price of Allah's worship in the dunya. The correct, the fair price of Allah's worship is Jannat. I'm telling you, the fair price. It's not the best price. It's the fair price. See, there's a fair market value of your house and then the real market value of your house. You know, when you worship Allah, you know, the fair market value is Jannat. You know, Allah Himself says that in the Quran. Right? He says that. In the Allah ishtara min al-mu'minina anfusahum wa amwalahum bi'anna lahum al-jannah. Allah has bought from the believers their lives and their wealth in exchange for Jannah. Jannah is a fair market value of the worship of Allah. You worship Allah, you have the right to ask for Jannah. You have to be in Jannah, you have the right to be there. This is a fair price that you can seek. Allah worship you, Jannah. Allah Himself will give it. But the real price is much higher than that. The real price that you should be asking for is much higher than that. This is the reason when you looked at those people who understood and had the marifat and who truly worshipped Allah, they did not belittle the worship of Allah by asking for Jannah also. See, no matter what, Jannah is also makhluk. Jannah is also a creation just like dunya is a creation. It's just that it's a better creation than dunya. That's the only thing. But it's still creation. But Ahlul Bayt knew that the real value of Allah's worship is the pleasure of Allah. They understood that the real market value of Allah's worship is nothing less than the pleasure of Allah. When you have the Creator and you are looking for the Creator, then what is... What is creation? This is the reason that those whose goal is heaven, those whose goal is heaven and they worship for heaven, Allah will give it to them. Allah will send them to heaven and they will be happy with what Allah gave them. But those whose goal is Allah, those who have made Allah their goal and Allah's pleasure their goal, then they're not satisfied with heaven. They want Allah. They want Allah's pleasure. They want Allah's companionship. They want Allah's mercy. They want Allah's friendship. This is what they want. That's the reason those who make Allah their goal is not Jannah. Jannah has made them their goal. They don't want Jannah. Jannah wants them. They don't honor Jannah by going to... They don't become honorable by going to Jannah. It is Jannah that becomes honorable by having them in there. You know? You know? A Jew who lived in Kufa, Iraq, and Muslim state, this was at the time of, you know, the Khilafah of Imam Al-Qaeda. And, you know, he knew the rulers who came before him. As he was walking past the masjid, every day he used to go by. You know, and the previous rulers used to sit on the member of the masjid and, you know, give their whatever speeches. As he was walking by, you know, all of a sudden he looked inside out of curiosity, looked inside and saw someone new there. And, you know, he was a little bit, you know, he just looked at it for a while and he became curious. He said, hey, who's this new person here? You know, came inside and looked at him carefully. And, you know, I mean, he was like a little bit shocked because, you know, he knew that this person on the member is different than the others who sat there. And he could see the difference. He went to the right and saw him. He went to the left and he was just like taken aback. He was shocked. And he came forward. And it was Imam Ali who was giving his speech over there and whatever rules he was giving there. He just looked at Ali. He said, "You are different. What are you talking about?" He said, "I saw all the people who came here before you." He's not a Muslim. He said, "I saw all the people who sat on this member before you. You know, they all got on the member. They gain respect by sitting on the member. My friends, if I sit on the member, I'm gaining respect from it. Oh, Mohan, he sits on the member. Right? You gain respect by sitting on the member. He said, all the people who came before, they gained respect by sitting on the member. But you are the only one I see that the member is gaining respect by you having it on. This is the difference, my brothers. Those people whose goal is heaven will go to heaven. But those whose goal is Allah, then it's heaven that will feel honor having them inside of heaven. You know, it's like, for example, there are some people, you know, when they live in a like a rich neighborhood, they want to live in a rich neighborhood. Because then they can say, oh, we live over here. You know, so everyone knows you're rich, right? So you gain respect by that, right? But you see that there's someone who, when they move to an area, that area becomes known because of them. This is the reason, my friends. Those who go to heaven will go there, but they will not become the master of heaven. You see, they will not become the master of heaven. Those who are the master of heaven, they are different. These are people whom Jannat is known by. You know, what is Jannat? Jannat is the land where Hussein rules. Jannat is the land where Hussein rules. Dunya is the land where Yazid, you know, might rule. What is Jannat? Jannat is where Hussein rules. Where Hussein is. You know, Jannat is known by Hussein. That's the reason when Imam Hussein bought the land in Karbala, he bought the land in Karbala. So our Imams have said that this Karbala is going to be joined in Jannah. He bought a land. The land is from this dunya. But because he bought it, now he became the owner. So now since he became the owner, that property will be added to his other property, which is Jannah. See, this is the difference, my friends. And here's where we see how it is important that these trials that we go through. Allah wants to see in these trials who is real and who is fake. They are real believers and they are fake believers. Everything you see, something real, something fake. You know, and when we look at the Imam, when we look at Imam Sajjad, we see Imam Sajjad, that Imam Sajjad cried a lot after Karbala. He cried so much that, you know, the underneath of his eyes were hollowed permanently. He cried so much. You know? And really, the musibah of Imam Hussein, the problem that Imam, I mean the difficulties that Hussein, his family had faced. Even after 1400 years, we hear about Enbiya crying. It's only natural that Imam would cry. But you see, there are some people who cry. Not all the crying is like Imam Sajjad. There's a difference in that also. Just like they are fake mu'min and they are real believers, then there are real crying and there's fake crying. You know? And here we see all these people who make excuses, you know, and you wonder at them, you know. They love Imam Hussein, they claim to love Imam Hussein, and they say that, well, you know, we cannot cry unless we hear it in a certain way. Unless we hear it in a certain way, we cannot cry. So Imam Hussein is not making you cry. It's that different way that's making you cry. We can't cry until we hear it in a certain language. So Imam Hussein is not making you cry. It's the language that's making you cry. You see, my friends, know what is real and know what is fake. When the trial comes, that's when it's known. Now, I will just give you some examples of some crying that happened with no drama. fall down at all, and the people cried. And I want you to see that cry and understand it and know why and how Imam Sajjad cried. Understand it from there. To give you some examples so you know this. The first example of crying we see for Imam Hussein. For Imam Hussein, the people who cried for Imam Hussein, we see the example in the court of Yazid. In the court of Yazid, the people in the court of Yazid, they all cried when they heard Imam Sajjad speak. When Imam Sajjad spoke, they all began to cry. And they were crying. And they're looking at the name was looking at this. Why are you crying? Sad. This is wrong. This is dhulm. He says, well, if you know it's dhulm, what are you doing about it? I mean, if you are crying for Hussein, if you are crying for the dhulm that was done in Hussein, why are you still sitting with Yazid? This is also crying. This is also crying. Now we come forward, we see that the second people who cried were the army of Ibn Sa'd. They all cried when they saw Imam Hussein bring out Ali Asghar. When Ali Asghar came out and put his tongue on his lips, he put his tongue on his lips and asked for water in his own special way, the whole army started to cry. That was also crying. Why are you crying for? Well, you see, this is all happening with a child. He said, you know it so, and you're crying, and you see the wrong happening, then what are you doing about it? You're still there. My friends, this is also crying. This is also crying for Hussein. Now let me give you a third example, so you know this better. And this example is from a riwayat from Umm Kulthum. Umm Kulthum has there's not a lot of riwayat from her, but this is one of them. Umm Kulthum really, she relates that after our tents were looted, after Imam Hussein was killed, our tents were looted. They came in our tents, they looted our tents, they burned our tents, we were outside. And while we were outside, they were trying to look for whatever we have, and someone came to, there's some person who came to Sakina. He saw the earrings on Sakina. And he asked for the earrings. Sakina was trying to take out the earrings. He was impatient. He couldn't handle it. And he went and tore off the earrings from her ears. Tore the earrings off, so the earlobe now broke open and the blood shed on the shirt of Sakina. Sakina was screaming in pain. She was screaming in pain. And this person, at the same time he was doing it, there are tears rolling down his eyes. He is crying, and tears are rolling down his eyes, and he's crying, and these are the words that he said. These are the words that he said. He was crying, and there's someone who went there and asked him, what are you doing? You're hurting the child, and you're crying at the same time. He said, yes. How can I not cry? And the words that he said is that, O Ahlul Bayt of my Prophet, who cannot cry for your pain? If your pain is given to the mountains will melt. He said, you fool, if you know this, then why are you still taking the earrings from her? See, he's crying and he's taking the earrings. Why are you taking the earrings? And he replies back, he said, if I don't, someone else will. Why should I take the loss? My friends, this is crying also. This is crying. So many people cried before Imam Sajjad did, that Imam Sajjad had to cry to show the world what is the real crying for Hussein. What does it mean to cry for Hussein? Imam Sajjad showed how to cry. That's why in his own house he used to call people and say, you know, read the poetry about the Masaib of Hussein. My friends, I want you to know, the Masaib of Imam Hussein we don't get from history books. Those who don't know better and who don't know how to do research, they go and look at history books to see where are the Masaib of Hussein. We don't hear it in the history book. Of course not. The history books were written by Umayyads. They were written by Bani Umayyah. The Imams They encouraged the Shias to write the Masaib of Imam Hussein in poetry. That's why we gained the Masaib of Imam Hussein from the poetry that was written. Imams used to ask them to read the poetry, and they would sit in those majlises hearing the poetry so that no one can doubt what is being said. They used to sit there themselves. And you see, Imam Sajjad would cry. And they would read the poetry, Imam Sajjad would cry. But when the azan is heard, he would stand up for prayer. He would stop. He would stand up for prayer. And when he prayed, and everyone would be like, all of a sudden, and immediately he would stop, stand up for prayer. He would pray, and as soon as he finished his prayer, as soon as he is done with his prayer, when he comes out of sajda, and he's done with his prayer, right away he will start to cry again. Right away he will start to cry. Before prayer he would cry, and right after the prayer he would cry. Someone would ask him, Imam, why are you crying immediately after prayer? He says, don't you see, I'm able to take my head out of sajda. Oh my poor father, when he went into sajda, they didn't allow him to get out of sajda. At the same time he's crying. At the same time, he's showing what is the importance of Allah's worship. You see, my friend, when iftar came in Ramadan, you see, every time he would take iftar, he would drink a glass of water, he would cry. And they would ask him, Imam, every time you do iftar, you cry. Why is this? Why do you do this? He says, how can I not cry? I'm breaking the fast of Allah with water. You know, even animals are given water before they are slaughtered. But my father Hussein, he was slaughtered without even being given water. Ajrakum Allah. My friend, this is the true crying of Imam Sajjad. This is how Imam Sajjad cried. When he went for Hajj, everyone was happy to be in the house of Allah. People are happy and gleeful, and they're all happy looking at the house of Allah. Imam Sajjad, when he went for Hajj, he would hold the drape of the Kaaba, and he would lament and cry out Allah. And when they would ask him, why are you crying? Why are you crying like this? You are in the house of Allah, and you're crying like this. He said, how can I not cry? The whole world comes to the house of Allah, but my father had to leave the house of Allah. My friend, Imam Sajjad has shown what is crying and how crying is done. What is the mourning of Hussein and what is the azah of Hussein? He has shown us that. This is the reason when you see, if you look at the life of Imam Hussein, 30 years he cried. 30 years he cried to show the believers what is the crying of Hussein, what is the mourning of Hussein, what is the azah of Hussein. And it was so that they asked someone who came from out of town, and they came from out of town to Medina, who were Shias of Imam Sajjad. They came to the house of Imam Sajjad. They came to his house, and he was not there. They met his maidservant. They gave their amanah to him, to her. And they asked her, we want to know something about Imam Sajjad. We want to know something about him so that we can take that lesson back with us. We can go back and take that lesson with us. So she asked them, do you want it in detail or do you want it in brief? He said, no. They asked her to give it in brief. Because we don't have time, we are leaving. Give it in brief, and we just want to see something that you know. He said, 30 years I have been a servant of my Imam. 30 years I have worked in this house. All I can say about Imam Sajjad is this. For 30 years I have never made his bed at night, nor I have cooked for him in the day. He says, what are you talking about? We didn't ask about you, we asked about Imam Sajjad. He said, can't you understand that? The whole night he would spend in the worship of Allah. He would never, I've never seen him sleep for 30 years at night, and I've never seen him eat in the day for 30 years. Every day he would cry for his father. Every day he would go and lament for his father and the pain that he had faced. We don't know what pain he is facing, what pain he went through. But you know, it has made him so hard. It has made him so emotional that 30 years he has not stopped crying. And whenever we ask him, what pain is it that has made you cry for 30 years? He said, Asham, Asham, Asham. Walk in the line. Yeah.